This is an Equity Bates Media podcast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Equity Minds!
I will say this about investing. Everything you do learn is cumulative. What I learned at 20 is useful.
Welcome to another episode of Equity Mates, a podcast that follows our journey of investing. Whether you're an absolute beginner or approaching Warren Buffett status, our aim is to help break down your barriers from beginning to dividend. My name is Bryce, and as always, I'm joined by my equity mate, Ren. How are you going?
I'm very good, Bryce. Very excited for this episode. I think one of the real privileges of getting to do this show for the last few years is meeting some pretty incredible investors and some pretty incredible funds, and I think we can safely say we've developed a bit of a man crush on the guys at TDM Growth Partners. We've interviewed Ed Cowan, Tom Cowan, Hamish Collette, and now we've got the big four. We've got Ben Giz joining us today.
Yes. Morning, guys. Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here. Thanks very much.
So Ben joined TDM Growth Partners when they had $70 million under management, and along with Hamish Collette and Tom Cowan, has grown TDM's assets under management to over $1.5 billion. Ben is a non-executive director at Pacific Smiles, which is one of TDM's portfolio companies. But Ben, we were going to call you co-founder of TDM, and I think for the first time ever on this podcast, someone has said they don't want that as a title. What is the story?
Yes, a lot of people do refer to me as the co-founder, but often like to use the opportunity to tell a bit of a story about the history. Founders have a very special spot in most businesses, and for us, the take on that was that think about a business being formed on someone's living room floor, surrounded in annual reports, waist deep, probably reading a lot of them in either your board shorts or your undies, whatever you like, and really doing that sort of hard grunt work in the early days. Tom and Hamish gave me a tap on the shoulder a short time later. A lot of hard work had been done by that phase. We got to 70 million of funds, and it's been a massive and very enjoyable journey since.
I mean, still, you've taken it from 70 to 1.5, so you've been part of the journey for a very long time.
Yeah, and the power of the team's the thing that's always really driven our success, and the combination of people, and not just the three of us, but the quality of person we've been able to hire since and allow them to buy into the dream as well.
Mm.
So, Ben, now for the rest of this interview, I'm just going to be imagining Tom Cowan in his undies surrounded by annual reports. So, thanks for that mental image. But look, we do like to start these interviews by hearing about people's first investments. We find there's generally a good story or some good lessons that come out of that investment. So, to kick us off today, can you tell us the story of your first investment?
Sure, I'd love to. And it's a bit of an odd one. You know, I think for most people, they probably talk about the first stock they bought. For me, I grew up in the country and it wasn't a proper farm, so no offence to all the real farmers out there. But I did grow up in a small property, and my first investment was a flock of Merino sheep. So I'd always been interested in this price value difference and what you could buy and sell at a differential to make a return. And I looked at ostriches and I looked at alpacas, and eventually my parents thought, you know, in order to get this guy to give up, we've just got to support him to buy a few sheep. And so that was the first investment I made. And in amongst other things, you know, I'd look at a bunch of specky stocks and pretend I owned them and things. But the first real money I put to work was in sheep.
Nice. I'm pretty sure Roger Montgomery's was a goat.
Yeah. Weird. Well, I did want a goat. I just wasn't allowed to get one.
So how did the investment turn out?
It went all right, actually. Now, I don't know whether this is one of these situations where your parents secretly underwrite an outcome to make sure you don't lose interest in investing. But certainly from my perspective, it was a good investment. And I haven't invested in a flock of sheep since. However, recently, I've bought 15 cows. So maybe is the time to revisit that trend.
There you go.
So, Ben, in your time at TDM, have you developed a personal investing philosophy?
Yes, I have. Rightly or wrongly, I think everyone's personal investing philosophy some way relates to their personality traits. One of my personality traits is I'm a bargain hunter. I have been spotted from time to time rummaging around in the $2 bin at the reject shop, for example. So I love a bargain. Even back at school, I was creating a secondhand market for school uniforms. So you can tell I like to hunt a bargain. I get excited by that, but over time my style's transitioned a bit. TDM style is more great companies at a reasonable price, and I think that's the right way to invest. In terms of other factors, simplicity is something I value a lot. So this ability to take a complex investment and summarize it on a page, I think, is something that's really, really important. Some people refer to that as the grandma test. I think that's very offensive to grandmas. I think how I consider it is more a layperson's test. You should be able to explain an idea on the page, not just your grandma, but anyone, and really articulate it in a simple way. And if that can't be done, I'd question whether it's a good investment. And the final thing is, just from a temperament point of view, I feel I operate better when times are tough and people are panicking and, you know, you have to make harder decisions when there's a lot of red on the screen. And I think that's a temperament aspect, and I feel like I like to play under that sort of situation more than a bull market.
Mm. So that temperament piece is a really interesting one, and I think something that a lot of our listeners probably haven't experienced. You know, we've seen a lot of listeners, and more broadly in Australia, a lot of people have started investing after the COVID drop. Is that temperament something that you can build, or what advice would you have for retail investors who haven't lived through a period where there's a lot of red on the screen?
I think you can build it. To have the right temperament at the right time, I think you do need to have a view of what happens after whatever blip you're going through. So if you don't have a solid view of a company in the first place, it is easy to panic. But assuming you do have a solid view of a company, you've just got to take your mind out of the short term into the long term. And your view has to be, I'm down on paper 50%, which might be a lot of money to you personally, but do I have confidence this company is going to make it through and is going to realize its value over time? And if the answer to that's yes, then you just really focus from the short term to long term. It's human nature to gravitate to the short term when you're in a panic.
Mm.
So we recently came across a blog post that TDM wrote on current market conditions, which was pretty fascinating for us because you guys aren't really known for often commentating on market conditions. You take that very long-term approach and try and remove yourself from the noise. So when we did see it, we thought it was worth unpacking, which is what we want to start with. In fact, you've only commented, I think, 4 times in the last 16 years on market conditions. So what is it about the current environment that has caused for you guys to give some public opinion?
Yeah, the way we think about it is, we don't think anyone's an expert to say the All Ordinaries S&P 200 is going to end up at, you know, X amount in a year's time and the return will be Y. You know, we just don't think that's realistic. We view the world as bottom-up investors. So we're constantly looking to find stocks bottom-up. Occasionally, we detect that the market environment is at an extreme point. So in the middle of the GFC, I would say there was an extreme point. And, you know, after a very, very long bull market, now we feel as though it's at quite an extreme point. But most of the time, it's in the middle. So where we have an opinion, it tends to be on either end of the spectrum when things are really dire and when things feel quite optimistic to us. So this is not some mathematical equation. This is us linking together, you know, a number of indicators, if you like, financial and non-financial, to get a feel for where the market is at generally.
So, Ben, in this blog post, you spoke about how the market's overheated. What are some of the key market indicators, or just more, I guess, societal indicators that point to the market being overheated?
Yeah, that's a great question, something that we have thought a lot about recently. First thing I want to say is that you've got to think about different markets differently. And a lot of our comments around the market being overheated do relate more to the growth part of the market, because that's the part that's really been supercharged. And within that, we talked a lot about the software space, which is an area we've invested a lot in. Some of the indicators we referred to in a blog post include IPOs, particularly tech IPOs, doubling day one or week one. You know, that's a routine thing that's happening. That's just not normal. Trading volumes, both equities and options, are up 50 to 100% year on year. Margin lending is the highest level it's been since 2008. And equity inflows are off the charts, you know, at a time also when valuations are high. So they're the metric-based indicators, and not just that one or two are something to worry about, but where all these things start happening, it's kind of like the canary chirping in the coal mine. The other bit is what I call the anecdotal test, which is that if you hear every taxi driver, shopkeeper, friend, whoever you speak to in the street, who previously had relatively little knowledge on investing, talking about how much money they've made and how hard it is to lose money, then generally you've got a problem.
You never like to hear the words highest since 2008 or highest since 2000. That's always a red flag. And, you know, yeah, we're definitely seeing it in, you know, everything from NFTs to the amount of stupid cryptocurrencies that are being made to Pokemon cards and baseball cards trading at all-time highs. There's so much money in the system, and it's just desperate to find places to go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So markets are overvalued, hot, whatever you want to say. But as you said, you're a bottom-up investor. So I guess in the simplest way to ask this question is, why does that matter?
Yeah, it's a great question. Something that, you know, both a lot of clients ask us and we debate a lot internally as well. So you're very right. We are bottom-up investors. So what that means is that we're looking at individual stocks and trying to form a view on whether they can deliver our returns, you know, which we're trying to target 20% plus per annum, 25% plus per annum. So that's always our true north. The reason it matters for us, the market environment, is that it goes to the opportunity set. So if we're at one end of the extreme or the other, like I've mentioned, either super optimistic or super pessimistic, you get your opportunity set changed. So for example, software companies, you know, in 2010 or 11, you could have thrown a dart at a dartboard and any one of those was going to deliver you a 20% return at that point in time. Now, that's different to saying, you know, when should I have invested and the market timing and so forth, but the environment's very target rich. Nowadays, I feel like we have to work a lot harder to find those gems. And so the reason it matters for us is the rate at which you need to work to find those two or three ideas to deliver our required returns. And we're fortunate. We only need to find two or three ideas a year. We only own 10 to 15 stocks, and we're not out there trying to find 50 companies that need to deliver our returns. So we've got an unfair advantage in that respect.
Yeah, yeah. So what are some of the key, I think, things that our listeners should be aware of in today's market environment? Obviously, we don't have the, you know, research capabilities that you guys do, but just as a retail investor, how should we be thinking about it?
Yeah, I think it's one of the trickiest times ever to invest. And when I say ever, I'm 43, so I don't necessarily say ever, but, you know, certainly in my investing lifetime. And the reason for that is back to this interest rate dilemma. You know, this environment encourages people to take their money out of the bank and do other things with it. So, you know, I can understand why people say cash is trash. You earn nothing from interest in the bank. So that gives investors a real dilemma. The older you are, the bigger the dilemma it creates, because, you know, if you're in a position where you need to start harvesting cash on a 2 to 3 year view, then it's very hard to take your money out of cash and do other things, because you need to have at least a 3 to 5 year view with equities. So it's very much a case of people aren't earning a return in the bank. Therefore, they are encouraged to make an investment in equities. You just need to be fearful when others are greedy. So our version of that is you hold more cash than you would normally hold, and you don't get caught up in this belief that you can't lose. Those two things. The second bit of it is, how do you invest as a retail investor, and what would your strategy be? We don't really get too much in the business of advising people what to do there, because, you know, I guess a little selfishly, we believe what we're doing is what we need to focus on. We think it's the right way of doing it. We don't think everyone can do the same thing. Not everyone has access to the same people, resources, and dedication to 15 companies that we do. So I often struggle to give retail investors advice. But what I often say is, if you really don't really know what you're doing, you know, you do go wider and you do own an ETF or some sort of broader index holding because, you know, you're less likely to trip up and fail on one company being a dud. But if you do genuinely have an interest in business and you do genuinely think you can have a crack at understanding the fundamental value of a business, maybe it's a business that you're very close to, you've got a family interest in it, you grew up around a retail business, something like that, then I do think there's an avenue to pick in individual stocks and take a view on them. I just always caution people to say, we would never buy a stock that we didn't very clearly have a view on the fundamental value of. And that's because our whole business is to buy at a price which is below that fundamental value and understand when it's reached that fundamental value. And if you don't know that equation, then I would argue it's closer to punting.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
So that's the sort of context in the market we're in. And we thought this was a good, I guess, context to talk about portfolio construction because, you know, when markets are hot and there's, you know, as you said, it's a difficult time to invest, that's when portfolio construction, I guess, is critical. Before we move there, I want to ask one more question about market conditions. You said you're a bit of a value guy or more of a value guy than Tom and Hamish, maybe. And we've been reading a bunch of investor letters for Q1 and there's a lot of talk about, you know, will value finally start to outperform growth again after a long period of growth outperforming? How do you think about growth v value in the coming years?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's not something that we specifically try and forecast because we're not trying to, you know, form a strategy around that question. Just before I go on, though, you know, I would say between Tom Hamish and myself, we would agree on 95% of the ultimate view on price, value, and how we proceed. It's normally that my investment setting mentality normally informs how that debate goes. So you always need in the room someone really driving that, you know, that passion for what the future could hold. And you also need a few people saying, hey, what about this? You know, and I think we've got the balance in the team between the two. Yeah. It seems to work well. So on your question of value and growth, look, all we're sensitive to is that in a zero interest rate environment, what do people want to own? Okay, of course you want to own structural growth businesses that are going to grow for 10 or 20 years above GDP and they're going to take market share from the incumbents. What a great spot to invest. I mean, that's why software companies are highly valued. That's why we love software companies and other structural growth businesses. But that pendulum always has an endpoint. Mm. And whatever's great tends to become too highly prized at some point in time. And so all we're saying is that we're getting towards one end of that spectrum. And therefore, I would infer that, you know, at some point in time, that value growth equation would swing around. We still think we can perform well in that environment because we only need to find a small handful out of 4,000 companies of high quality growth businesses.
Mm, mm.
So I think naturally, inevitably, that equation swings around.
Yeah.
So before we jump into portfolio construction, we'll take a quick break for our sponsors.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, Ben, before we overlay current market conditions with how you're thinking about constructing a portfolio, let's just talk about some of the basics of what you're doing at TDM. Do you have any rules for which you apply to your portfolio construction?
Yeah, so the way we think about portfolio construction is, first and foremost, we are believers in concentration. You know, and again, this is different to a retail investor's perspective, but our fundamental belief is there's not that many great investments out there, and our chances of delivering superior returns comes down to our ability to hold a small number of very good businesses that can deliver great returns. And it's a constant battle to find those great businesses.
How many are we talking? What is concentration for you?
So our version of that is 10 to 15 businesses. But realistically, it's even more concentrated than that, because within that mix, I can talk about the composition a bit more, but there'll be some quite large positions and then a tail of smaller positions.
Mm. And then Tadium invests in both private markets and public markets. Do you have any rules around that aspect of for your portfolios?
Yeah, so I'll give you an overview of how we think about it. So just, I guess, going back a step. So we've got about $1.5 billion, which we try and invest globally. We try and find the best 10 to 15 companies. We want to own businesses and help businesses that we're proud of. That's our mission. We are looking for businesses that have structural growth at a high rate, outstanding people and culture, and excellent sustainable competitive advantage. So those three dimensions. So we're finding bottom-up stocks that meet that criteria and that can deliver a 25-ish percent per annum return. Then we say, okay, how do we factor those into the portfolio? As I said, 10 to 15 stocks, but our view of how much of those stocks you should own is roughly done like this. A small position for us might be around 3% of the portfolio. A large position would be about 15%. So you could say, well, if you've got your best company, why not make that 35% or 50%? Because you'll get higher returns, right? You know, if your highest returner is 50%. But, you know, however, you know, solid we think our investment record is, there's always margin of error. And you can get things wrong. And in any given year, the company that we think is going to do the best doesn't always do the best, for example. And so there is a limit, we think, from a risk point of view to how much you should have in one stock. So we have small position, large position, and then we scale everything in between depending on their risk-adjusted returns and you know how confident we are in the future for those businesses.
And how do you think about like cycling out businesses from that concentration? Like you've put all this work in to find 15 of the best stocks. If you then find a company that is going to be generating 2 or 3% extra in return than what's already in there, do you rebalance, cycle it through? How does that process work?
Yeah, we are pretty methodical about how we do that. So what we do is we've always got this equation, if you like, between what we think the fair value of a business is and where the business is trading. So from time to time, and particularly in this environment, you can get that gap close up. And when that gap close up, naturally, we want a smaller position. So the way we see it, we will gradually sell down, or sometimes at speed, sell down and increase the position depending on that differential between market price and what our impression of intrinsic value is.
Yeah, right. And then in terms of portfolio, something that we are all sort of debating at the moment as well is cash and the weighting of cash. How do you think about cash weighting?
Yeah, I think this is quite different to many investors. So we have held about 20% of our portfolio in cash across the cycle, you know, across our 16 years in business. And that is an unusual position when you think about it, because, you know, I think most people would agree that generally speaking, you're not in a bear market. Bear markets are occasional. And so therefore, shouldn't you be mostly fully invested, particularly if you've got all these great ideas, you know, that you can invest in and make a 20% return? What we've come to realize over time, and well, from day one actually, is that the option value of having a reasonable cash holding is extremely valuable and is underestimated by most people. Again, you can fall into this trap. Hang on, interest rates are zero. That's just dead money. But, you know, we are able to and have done in the past deploy 15 to 20% of our portfolio in a matter of weeks into dirt cheap companies, which we rarely get the opportunity to buy. And so that has allowed us, I think, to improve our returns over time. I think the one shift we've made in the last couple of years is to recognize that as we invest in bigger and better quality businesses over time, you get management teams that just continue to produce magic and you know, the intrinsic value keeps growing faster than you think. And so therefore you may look back and regret having sold something that, you know, doesn't meet that differential between value and price criteria on the day. So I think we've become a bit more relaxed about holding ultra high quality businesses, but still maintaining a discipline around adjusting position size for valuation. Yeah. Some investors, of course, including Buffett, will say, you just hold the companies that you love and just never let go of them. And so we've got a different twist on that. We think valuation always plays a role.
Mm. I mean, that's the incredible thing that even, you know, when we started learning about investing, you know, everyone reads the, you know, the security analysis and the Buffett letters. And there's this real concept of mean reversion that comes through in there where, you know, companies go above their fair value and then they'll come back to their fair value. But what we've seen with companies like Apple and Microsoft is that they just keep compounding away and incredible rates of returns for decades.
Phenomenal. And they're two great examples. And our ideal investment is a type of investment that does that, that continues to surprise you with magic. And we can come on to people and culture in a bit, no doubt, but people and culture is typically the key ingredient to make that magic happen.
So you've said there that some of these rules of portfolio construction don't apply for retail investors, but I think the thing that really comes through is that, one, you have pretty clear rules that you all understand and that you all stick to, and two, price plays an incredibly important role in how you sort of apply those rules and how you think about it. And I guess the third one is that you know your companies incredibly well. Yeah. And I think those three things definitely apply for any investor.
Yeah, and I've got some friends, for example, who are knowledgeable about property, and they ask me, so what shares should I buy? And I agree that they should spread their wealth around a little bit, but my natural instinct is to say, you're all over this property game. You know it back to front. I'd be super concentrated in what you're doing, and I keep hammering that away. You've got an unfair advantage. And I flip that around, I have the same view of stocks.
I guess our ears picked up at the 20% cash weighting through the cycle. That, as you said, that's unusual. For a retail investor, you know, having cash on the sideline is important, but, you know, you often get an itchy finger and you're seeing all these companies run and you're seeing crypto run and you're seeing buy now, pay later run. And at the same time, you know, Bryce, I think for 4 years when we started the show, was predicting a bear market and was holding cash, and it never really came. Well, it came in 2020 eventually. So I think that decision about when should you have cash, how much cash you should hold as a retail investor is difficult. Obviously, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, but how would you think about the cash weighting as a retail investor?
Yeah, I think everyone's got to have their own version of playing offense and defense. And that's what we talked about in our blog post. You know, what is your version of aggressive and conservative? And match that to the environment that you're in. So, for example, our version of that, being quite playing defensive, a little defensive right now, is in our case 15 to 20% cash. We've been up as high as 50% cash before and aggressively moved our cash weighting to zero when the opportunity sets massive. And so I think if I'm a retail investor, I think, well, what's my version of that? That does come down your risk appetite and other things, but I would find it very hard to understand a retail investor at this point in the cycle not having, you know, 10 to 20% cash somewhere ready to deploy when things are less rosy. And I particularly say that because not just equities that are enjoying significant inflation, you know, there's a, you know, some could argue this is the bubble of everything that's been going on, and there'll be opportunities in the future.
It is actually everything, like not just traditional assets, but like sneakers and everything.
Cows too, as it turns out.
Really? Yeah. We need to get on the livestock market.
True.
So I think they're sort of the rules of portfolio construction that you guys have. Would love to now overlay current market conditions and understand how you're thinking about portfolio construction at the moment. I guess, you know, how are those rules holding up? Are you still finding opportunities? Do you have to reduce that 10 to 15 number because everything's quite hot?
Yep.
How are those rules holding up at the moment?
So we're lucky. I think we've still got an unfair advantage, which I think is a point I want to keep making. You know, as we point out at the start, we can invest in public and private businesses anywhere in the world. We've probably got an opportunity set of 4,000 plus companies. And we're only trying to find two or three a year. And so within that, you know, we might find one private company, two public companies, or the other way around. And within that, you know, we might find that we have one sort of tens of billions market cap public company and one that's sort of a billion, you know, in the growth phase. So we've got all those opportunities. And I think that strategy is working really well right now because we've got certain companies in the portfolio that are just making massive gains in their intrinsic value. You know, I just think about a classic Aussie success story, Guzman Gomez. It's just shooting the lights out and is going to be, if it's not already, a great Aussie success story and hopefully one day a global success story. So that's ticking away in the background, growing intrinsic value really fast. It gives us the luxury on the public side to be really choosy about when we buy new companies. So we are able to generate those returns across the cycle by having that mix of public and private investments and not being forced to, you know, I guess if you look at one strategy, if we're all private equity, we need to do four deals a year in private companies. Or if we're public only, we need to hold 100% of our funds in public companies. We're able to dip in and out where the best companies and teams of people reside.
Mm. There's no doubt that markets can remain pretty irrational for quite extended periods of time, and you've recognized that we're at a reasonably frothy, overvalued point in the market. But if that were just to continue for year on year, and you know what we're seeing just pushes further, how do you adjust, or do you adjust any of your rules? And particularly for the retail investor, if you are sitting in cash, it's pretty hard to stay there and watch the market continue. So how do you kind of think through that?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting dilemma. I mean, because of this other dimension to our business and having companies that are not yet in the public domain and that are growing in the background, we do have the luxury to hold cash and bide our time. I think it's a realistic scenario that in a market environment like this, valuations still keep going up. It just comes down to probability and timing of when a potential correction happens. So I think we're well positioned for that. Obviously, if you look back in 3 years' time and the bull market's extended, we would have been better off having that 15-20% cash in the market. And that's something we won't know till the time. But what we're saying is we can generate our returns with that cash holding.
There was an investor we spoke to, I can't remember when, but there was sort of like rules. He had rules around, you know, if a stock dropped, you know, 10%, he would deploy 10% of his cash into the market. And he had like a rules-based approach for a market downturn. Do you guys have a similar approach? And maybe like if we talk about a specific example, Spotify, a company that you guys have invested in for a while, has come off a little bit. Do you have a rules-based approach where it's like, all right, we're going to put some more in and some more in if it keeps dropping, or is it?
Yeah, so Spotify is a great example. I mean, great companies, as we've discussed, tend to grow their intrinsic value over time. Less great companies are either flat in terms of what their fundamental intrinsic value is or down. So Spotify is a great example of a company that continues to grow its competitive advantage and its intrinsic value. So the way that translates into our decision-making is we're constantly researching the business, understanding the industry better and, you know, comparing it to other opportunities, I guess, but really coming up with what our view of fundamental value is. And as that ratchets up over time, we factor that into our holding of the business and relate that back to the share price. So it may be that the share price goes up, but the intrinsic value keeps going up faster, and that's an ideal scenario for us. So if you think about it, it's hard to draw a graph on audio, but if you think of a graph with you know, valuation on the vertical axis and time on the horizontal axis, you think of intrinsic value being a straight line up and to the right, and you know, share price a squiggly line below that. Our ideal company looks like that because you can continue to hold it for many years to come, even though the share price is going up. So obviously, as the share price goes down, and Spotify is no different, if the share price is falling, we are in the market buying shares to recognise the growing difference between intrinsic value and where the share price sits.
On that point, how did you guys approach the world's fastest crash in March 2020?
Yeah, interesting. So we were investing heavily in that scenario. Prior to that, we were worried about valuations, so had harvested a fair bit of cash and valuations were high. They happen to be higher now. but going into that, we were deploying money fast. I think what we got wrong, in inverted commas, is we were probably too cautious and then started to reduce some of those positions as we came out the other side because we were really worried about where the world was at. And in fact, looking back, it's hard to fathom how well asset prices performed when the world was in a massive malaise. And I still can't really fathom that, to be honest. My only rationale is that interest rates are so low, and back to this thing that all assets go up in that scenario. But so we would have, you know, we made fantastic returns the last 12 months, but they would have been better, even better, if we'd hold on to some of those positions a bit longer, because obviously the market's been much stronger than what anyone had thought.
A lot of retail investors will just buy the dip because they're told buy the dip, even though and take no consideration into price. You're saying you're deploying cash in March 20 really quickly. Was it all driven, though, by the underlying stock price, yeah. or were you just like, now's an opportunity, let's get it in there?
Yeah, so we have a watch list, you know, 50 plus companies. Some of those we know better than others, but the ones we know well, we will have a very specific buy price attached to it. And we will adjust that buy price as new facts come to light. And that buy price will be independent of what's going on in the market around us. Now, of course, it becomes tempting to change some of your assumptions, you know, when you see that all the comps to a company are trading at a certain level, but we really do try and be disciplined about looking through the cycle. Yeah, so it's quite a methodical approach when it comes to what the buy price should be.
I find that 2020 period interesting because, you know, on one hand, you're looking at your assumptions about the intrinsic value of a company and the future prospects of a company, and you're saying, well, this is a good price that the market's giving us. But on the other hand, there's so much uncertainty for some of the businesses that you own about what the future actually does hold. You know, a company like Spotify, all online, not as affected by COVID. But, you know, another company that you own, Pacific Smiles, is all physical locations. And, you know, if the economy shut down, the future becomes incredibly uncertain. So how do you build models and make assumptions about some of those companies at a time like the start of COVID?
The key is to have a go at looking through that event, whatever it is, and try and come up with some view. So we're always trying to look 5 years out. It's not to say that COVID doesn't have some form of disruption on that five-year view, but we look 5 years out. So as you mentioned, I'm involved with Pacific Smiles and on the board there. If you just take that as a case study of how that played out in market prices, in the middle of COVID, that stock was trading at 80 cents. Why? Because I guess people inferred dental services can't be delivered. You know, it's going to be a difficult environment. You know, maybe you're going to make some losses for a bit, whatever the case might be. If you take a forward look 5 years from that point in time, you say, okay, are dental services still going to be delivered in the way that they were pre-COVID? Who's going to be delivering them? Who are the market winners? And therefore, what's the earnings power of the business at that point in time? If you ran that equation, the valuation wouldn't change for the business. So you had a situation where the stock price was 80 cents, now trading, you know, 275-ish. And for those willing to see red on the screen and to deal with uncertainty in the short term, provided you know what that endpoint is or have a view on that endpoint, that's the way you make returns.
Yeah. And I guess the other thing at the time was, do they have like the balance sheet to get through that period as well?
Absolutely. And we're massive believers at TDM in balance sheet flexibility. Basically, across our portfolio, we're in net cash positions for all our businesses. And, you know, and I've heard a lot of companies say, well, why don't we just borrow more money? You know, it's so cheap. What happens, you know, if you can't pay that interest bill for a month, a covenant's breached, you have to do an emergency capital raise? It's all about that optionality piece and flexibility. And you look at the companies that have done really well through COVID, it's ones that have been able to stick to their strategy or enhance it when their competitors are floundering and really double down and invest. And those are the ones with stronger balance sheets.
So many of the Equity Mates community take a dollar cost average approach. And just to kind of close out the conversation around market conditions, how do you think about dollar cost averaging at a time like this?
So I don't mind the idea of spreading a buy decision over a period of time. I mean, we do essentially do that as well. I also think the less you know about a particular company or, you know, a particular situation, you know, putting all your money into one stock on a particular day if you don't know much about it is probably a bad strategy.
Yeah.
So intuitively, I don't mind it for retail investors.
Yeah, nice.
So Ben, we want to thank you for joining us today. This has been a fascinating conversation. Definitely given us and the Equity Mates community a lot to think about. Aside from going out and reading the TDM blog post on current market conditions, do you have any sort of final thoughts or final words for the retail investing community?
Sure, and I've really enjoyed this. I know I've given a bit of advice around, basically, if you don't really know everything about the companies you're investing in, take a wide strategy and be quite passive. And if you know a lot about the companies you're investing in, be concentrated and hold on to the things you know well. The other thing I'd mention, strategies like TDM strategies are hard to get involved in, hard to access. But one method of getting something similar is to invest in Hearts and Minds Investments. So the code there is HM1. That is an investment company which is built to help community and specifically help medical research. So there's a bunch of managers involved in picking the stocks for that company, and we're one of them. The managers don't make fees, but that fee is effectively paid towards those charitable endeavours in health research, health and medical research. So yeah, that would be one way of doing it.
We've had a bit of a chat about HM1 on the show and interviewed some of the managers, and it's rare that, you know, you guys at TDM, Hamish Douglas, and, you know, some of the other best investors in Australia come together, and it's for a good cause. So, yeah, we're big fans of what they're doing over there.
Fantastic. Thanks.
So, Ben, we're almost out of time. We do have a final three questions we end every interview with. But before we do, if the Equity Mates community want to find out more about yourself or TDM, where should they be going?
Well, as everyone will joke amongst my colleagues at TDM, they'll say I hide in the shadows. It's very hard to find me, except I respond on the occasional LinkedIn piece. But in terms of discovering more about TDM, our website's a great resource for that. There's, I believe, heaps of good content there. If you look at when we started out, you know, there was no content that TDM produced, and now we are really trying to change the way the investment community works for the better, and we really think it's our duty and service to help the finance community do better than what they've done in the past, and we want to be driving that.
Well, I can say between yourself, Hamish, Tom, and Ed, you've definitely helped our community, so we appreciate it, and yeah, people should go and check out the TDM website. Now, we'll get into the final three questions. First one, do you have any books that you consider must read?
Yeah, and this reflects my own personal style as well. You know, I think One Up on Wall Street by Peter Lynch is a classic, and it really plays to this view I have that if you can understand a business as a layperson, then that's a great start. If you're going to pick individual stocks, that's almost a must-have. So it's just an intuitive, common sense book, which I think every budding investor should read and would be a really, really useful resource.
In 60 seconds or less, what's the best company you've ever come across?
This is a super hard question.
Yeah.
Because best company, you know, I could, we've never owned Apple, but I could say, you know, Apple's one of the world's best companies because of what they've achieved, and they've showed people that, you know, who thought they were a hardware business and, you know, wouldn't grow as fast as they had, that actually they're a must-have software-hardware combination that's going to be here forever and is always going to continue to, you know, outstrip expectations. When I look at, from our point of view, what is perfect, it's a company like Mineral Resources, which we own here in Australia. And the reason I've picked Mineral Resources for this answer is, well, firstly, what is Mineral Resources? It's a mining services infrastructure company which listed, you know, 16 years ago, basically when we started. We've owned it since that time, about 100 million market cap at that point in time, and now it's 8.5 billion. Now, you think of a company in the mining services industry and you think, you know, perhaps not as innovative, you know, slower growth, susceptible to the vicissitudes of the cycle and so forth. Mineral Resources is one of the most innovative, forward-thinking businesses that we've ever seen, and that has allowed them to continuously exceed expectations and do things that others weren't able to do. So back to my earlier point about maintaining that gap between intrinsic value and share price and being able to own something for a long period of time, their intrinsic value has continued to grow very, very fast, and the share price has also grown, and that's what's allowed us to be long-term partners with them and investors in the company.
Yeah, it's a crazy company. It is the definition of bottom left to top right in terms of share price growth. So final question, if you think back to your younger self, you know, when you're buying that first flock of sheep, what advice would you give to your younger self?
I think a few things. So don't become susceptible to overconfidence. You know, I think, you know, like, know your limitations and invest in your circle of competence. That's number one. Number two, you know, be around the best people that you can be around and people who are complementary to your skill set. I think one of the key ways that TDM's become successful is the combination of people. 1 + 1 = 5 or 10 or whatever it is. And I've learnt that on boards. I've learnt that in the investment sphere, and I've learnt that, I guess, in social communities. And that just is something that I keep coming back to. Final thing relates to that. I guess people and culture is always the thing that delivers that ultimate positive surprise in the long term. And even now, I continue to underappreciate how powerful that is. And, you know, we obviously have spreadsheets and we have research and we have all sorts of fundamental discovery tools. But ultimately, that team of people who continues to surprise and innovate and develop is what's ultimately going to be a sustainable competitive advantage.
Well, Ben, it has been, as always, an absolute pleasure speaking with you and everyone from TDM. You always provide such great value for our audience, and you know they certainly do appreciate what you guys are doing. So I would reiterate that if you are listening and want to know more, definitely head to the TDM website. As Ben said, plenty of great resources there, and you get a really good insight into how you guys are thinking. So very much appreciate your time, and we hope to connect again at some point.
Thanks very much, and it's an absolute pleasure to be a part of this. From TDM's perspective, we love what you guys do, and we're really, really happy to support it. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Equity Mates Investing Podcast is a product of Equity Mates Media. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal, or tax advice. The hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast are not financial professionals and are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from a podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Equity Mates website where you can find ASIC resources and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Equity Mates Media and the hosts of Equity Mates Investing Podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.